Weighing the Past to Assess the Future. Jagjit Chadha, National Institute of Economic and Social Research. Thank you to colleagues at Sussex and elsewhere for organising this event in Nick's honour, in particular Sambit for inviting me to contribute. I am so very sorry that I cannot be there in person. Please do forgive me. The great tragedy of Nick's death last year is self-evident, but within that is that his retirement plan had been so well formulated, teaching at Sussex and becoming chair of the Council of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. These complementary jobs allowed him to continue research and policy advice, at which he excelled. He even found time to be elected president of the Royal Economic Society. And so we're all sorely missing his down-to-earth Nottingham frankness. Nick was actually something of a hero to me. I read his book, British Economic Growth During the Industrial Revolution, as an undergraduate in the late 1980s. And to learn the basic point that revolution was more evolution has stayed with me. That the leading and most innovative industries may not be good indicators as to the performance of the whole or the rest of the economy seems obvious with a moment's thought. And that positive change may have to have much deeper origins than a sudden dash for growth. But such misreadings are still made regularly. Only last year, when the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, was making the case that AI and fintech could rapidly raise total factor productivity, he was repeating the mistakes that Nick had corrected. In fact, three of our biggest policy errors, I will place Brexit in its own special category of poor policy formulation and execution, involved making the fundamental error of not understanding that aggregate supply cannot be improved that quickly. So in 1973, the Barber boom stimulated demand when it had already become excessive relative to supply following oil price shocks that had led to a fall in our productive capacity. In the late 1980s, the Lawson boom followed an incorrect inference that the faster growth we were observing was a supply-side phenomenon, or, in the language of the time, a permanent increase in income prospects, and so not requiring significantly tighter monetary policy. And more recently, who could forget the mini-budget of 2022, which made the schoolboy error of targeting a rate of growth in GDP that it was not simply possible to achieve. And it even tried to inject 2-3% of GDP, in terms of demand, into an already inflationary economy. What we do know from history is that the UK has had relatively poor productivity performance since the Second World War, except for the 1980s and the period around the turn of the century. And what we also know is that there's been a lot of scarring where regions and places that have suffered large negative shocks associated with deindustrialisation have, with only one or two exceptions, been permanently pinned back. The creation of regional disparities is itself a post-industrial phenomenon. Look at the Peace Hall in Halifax, the existence of the stock exchanges and country banks around the country, to realise that the first industrial nation had a spatial element to its growth. T.S. Eliot, writing Wasteland, had no hesitation or irony in calling out a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. The 19th century seemed to be a period where regional wage inequalities improved, albeit slowly. In 1986, Hunt wrote, "This erosion of spatial differentials was a very gradual process up to 1914. Our debate since 2010 on austerity or sound money, take your pick, might well have been helped by more understanding of history rather than the mechanical adherence as to whether R is greater than G or the other way around, which is anyway, for those who know the theory, a steady state condition and in no circumstances can be used as a guide to short-run policy. A close look at the UK historical record after periods of rapidly increasing debt does not suggest that debt was inflated away or that markets were running scared, but very good credit history. Obviously, in the longer sweep of history, Britain enjoyed the exorbitant privilege that now benefits the USA. As a reserve currency, sterling assets were of particular value. As is well known, the fall in debt as a share of GDP after the Napoleonic Wars is well explained by a long period of economic growth. Indeed, the mild deflation did not help, but it was growth that permitted a long sequence of primary surpluses to be maintained. Comparing the 1920s and the 50s, there was a more gradual fall in the 1920s, as there was on average a deflation, real income growth was low, and even though the primary surpluses were extraordinarily high by modern standards, they could not chip away much at the debt level, because the average interest rate on debt was some 4.6% on a debt stock that was itself nearly twice GDP. The remarkable fall in public debt to GDP in the 1950s of nearly 90%, or of some 90%, results from an inflation rate that was nearly 5% higher and a real growth rate of over 3%. The primary surplus was just about offsetting the interest burden, which while there was significantly more debt, the average interest rate was significantly lower, at just over 3%. Obviously, stewardship of the national debt is important, but in setting policies since 2010, we have consistently misunderstood or underestimated how important economic growth has been in bringing down debt as a share of GDP. In March 2009, bank rate went to 0.5%, which was at that point an historic low for the Bank of England with a three-century history. Although it now stands at 5.25%, in the normalisation of bank rate that started in December 2021, we only reached 0.5% in March 2022, a 13-year period of bank rate bumping along the bottom. It was argued by many that this was the rate required to stabilise inflation at around 2%, and so reflected some notion of R-star, which is the rate that clears savings and investment. To be honest, nobody knows what R-star is quantitatively. Maybe given weak demand around the world and domestically, such low rates were required for an extended period to support normal demand. But had we looked carefully at previous experience, there were two points that perhaps we might have been thinking more carefully about. The prolonged period of which there was no change in rates, as well as the level, might have had longer-term implications for financial structure. Did low rates trace the demand curve for private and public debt? And did an extended period of cheap money push asset and house prices to elevated levels? If so, they would have contributed to wealth inequality, but also a reduction in labour mobility. So unlike the textbooks, has monetary policy in this period, over the last decade, had a real significant effects on the economy? But the past, as the present and the future, is also not fully knowable. Context, of course, helps. Since the new year, we've had a narrative about recession and recovery. The calling of a technical recession was an example of how the news and the political cycle can drive out the truth. Academic business cycle analysis would never use two recent quarters' estimates of GDP to deploy the R word, whether it is the MBR, the EABCN, or the UK Business Cycle Committee, hosted by NISA, on which Stephen Broadbury, Ryland Thomas, Jason Leonard and many others sit. We know that data can be revised for some years after the initial estimate. But in any case, and more importantly, any recession is really a sustained and material fall in economic activity across a range of sectors. A fall of a fraction of a percent is basically zero in my view. The narrative of recession and recovery really ought to be replaced by one of continuing doldrums, as we have had very little growth since 2022, and income per head has stagnated for quite some time. Indeed, the real problem is the break, or doing breaks, in the path of output per head since 2010. That is the more important story. But of course, even if we wait, we will never really know what happens, or what happened. In The Money Minders, my book published last year, I looked at the causes of the early 1920s recession and then the relatively mild one the UK suffered after the Wall Street crash. Using data constructed well after these events and recent econometric techniques, I wrote that it was possible to argue that both were driven largely by negative monetary policy shocks rather than spending shocks. But again, I go on to argue that these results do not really settle the Temin debate for the UK. Not really, I argue. What if the data is noisy? What if the curves are not stable? What if expectations mattered? If not spending, why did unemployment rise so rapidly? The real contribution of my analysis was to invite an even deeper dive into the causes of things. And that is how it should be. A subsequent paper for the Keynes Versailles volume, published earlier this year, looked at how tariff policy may have stabilised prices and prevented expectations of deflation taking hold, with all the negative momentum that that can create. On a final note, we know that Nick finished at the top of the economics tripos at Cambridge as a student, and perhaps his work was the end point of a great generation of economic historians working at Cambridge. From Phyllis Dean and William Cole, with the estimates that Nick improved, Charles Feinstein, who was providing estimates of national income from 1855 to 1865, and very careful with it. Robin Matthews' work on business cycles, and before the magnum opus of Stephen Broadbury's excellent team, which includes Alex Klein, perhaps wrote the definitive book on British economic growth with Feinstein and Nodlin Smee. And also, we shouldn't forget the parallel work of Tony Wrigley and Roger Schofield in constructing population estimates of England from the 16th and 19th century. At the same time, my old friend Brian Redaway's examination of FDI and tax was an attempt to provide practical answers to our economic puzzles. At the time, we had a corpus of economic historians piecing together an evolving picture of the British economy that provided such marvellous context to our economic problems. I think we're missing that today. I mention all these names because they are fast receding from the collective memory. In economics departments until recently, there's been very little space for economic history. And yet when crises come along, we always turn first to the history books for lessons. Not that I think there are necessary lessons from history. There are no lessons from history. Not that I think there are necessary lessons from history. But if we listen carefully, we can sometimes hear an echo. Who was the author that everyone started reading after the financial crisis of 2008? Charles Kindleberger. He wrote, "Surpluses, the liquidity crisis, exchange depreciation, and finally bank failure and money collapse produced the fateful mixture," in his classic On the Great Depression. My point is not that good, careful, rigorous knowledge of historical episodes and data can guarantee the avoidance of economic policy failure, but where models have their own internal consistency that may not match the foibles of a disappointing world, and where locating the correct instrument may help us pin down a parametric response, economic history provides context. The careful weighing of the past allows us to confront whatever comes along, Brexit, COVID, war, or the US presidency being held by a criminal deviant, with many more informative priors as to how things will play out. The next problem is to get people to listen. Thank you. And to Nick, thank you. Cheers.